I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue, January 22nd, 2019. This is not one of the larger audiences I expect we will have in future hearings, but welcome to the committee. Mr. Allenwell.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So basically for the agenda today, you have the organizational meeting, so some member and staff introductions. All of LRO is here. We can go. It's helpful to connect faces with names so we can go through that. And then after that, we can do the work session to adopt the committee rules. And then to kick off a week or two of overviews or orientations, we have one on a high level overview of the Oregon Revenue System. I'll give that presentation for today. And then as we go through the next few days, the staff, everybody, all of the economists in LRO will be going through orientations on their respective fields. So I can introduce the...
Let's do the LRO introductions now.
Okay. We have Mazen Malik. He's a veteran, and he handles transportation, carbon, miscellaneous excise taxes, marijuana, alcohol. He is splitting up some of the vices. He has those. And then he's one of the senior economists. And Dave Beck is the other senior economist. He primarily handles school funding. He also helps with some labor taxes, so unemployment insurance, as well as he's helping out with some business taxes. And then we have three economists, Kyle Easton, who is handling the personal income tax and kind of taking the lead on the tax credit review process this time. For veteran members, I had been doing that in prior years, but with Paul retiring, we've had a shuffling in the office. And then Jamie McGovern, this is her first long session. She was here for the short session, and she's handling property taxes and natural resources. And then Kate is our newest economist, and she has been here for 6 weeks. She comes to us from Florida, and she is helping out with the corporation income excise tax, some business taxes, and she's also taking up and helping with some of the vices, with some tobacco. And I forgot to mention, Day is also helping with tobacco. Corinne Gibbett is the office manager. And then we have a returning committee assistant, Austin. He will be handling House revenue, I think, for the first time. In the past, he's done Senate, I think. And then Isaac is new to the office. He's here handling he's the committee assistant for the Senate Finance and Revenue. And back at the office holding the fort down is Sarah. She's our receptionist for the session. So,
and if you're watching, Sarah, hello.
So for any members, if you have any questions, you can contact me, or you can go directly to the economist in that area. Or if you're not sure, you can contact Sarah, and then Sarah or Corinne or Austin or Isaac, and then we'll get you to the right person to get you the information that you need.
Great. Thank you. Now that we're all here, you all probably know who we are. You can see our name tags. Staff have undoubtedly been looking at the composition of the committee. But let's introduce ourselves just so you hear our voices if you haven't spoken with us yet in person. Let's start at this end, please.
E. Warner Rashley, State Rep, House District 56, which is Southern Klamath and Lake Counties, and we guard 101.1 miles along the California border.
Barbara Smith Warner, State Representative from House District 45, which is Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Groves, and this is my third time on the Revenue Committee.
Good morning. I'm Representative Lynn Finley from House District 60, serving Malheur, Harney, Grant, Baker, part of Lake County, all of Southeast Oregon.
I'm Nancy Nathanson. I represent District 13. That's primarily North Eugene and downtown Eugene.
And I'm Pam Marsh. I have House District 5, which is Southern Jackson County. Werner and I actually share a line. And when he did that calculation, I went back and looked at my district, and I think I have 80 miles of California border. Not quite as much, but a chunk.
I had to ask LPRO to do that for me. So.
Good morning. I'm Greg Smith. I represent District 57. Good morning. I'm Representative Hernandez from House District 47 in Outer East Portland.
Open a work session now, right? Are you ready for that?
To adopt the...
Yes. I'm opening a work session to adopt the committee rules.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, the rules are largely the same as in previous sessions. The biggest change has to do with the attribution. And in specifically in the committee rules, House Rule 10 is basically saying that any, from this point forward, any committee introduced, any bill introduced by the committee or any amendment not only needs the name of the member or committee, but if it's at the request of somebody, it needs to have that name. And so there's just that identification that will be accompanying those.
Okay. Any question about the rules? Any objection to the rules? Is there, we need a formal motion probably to adopt the rules, don't we?
So, yeah.
Could we have a motion, please?
I would so move.
Thank you. Discussion on the motion. Any objections? Motion passes unanimously. The rules are adopted. And I am closing that work session and opening an informational meeting, general revenue orientation. Well, now the work begins.
So I'm just going to bounce down.
Thank you.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. So just to kick things off, we'll have a series of informational meetings on that are basically an orientation or overview. We were thinking about this, and it's been a while since we did this, so I don't know. The mics are much more sensitive than in the past. That the members on the committee have gone through this directly. Of course, as issues get discussed, there's an orientation there, some familiarity. But just to start things off, I'm going to go through an overview. So the presentation here is split up into four areas. Am I the only one hearing that?
Hearing what?
That's it.
What are the Oregon's sources of revenues? How has the revenue system...
It's weird.
It's really annoying.
Yeah. A little hot.
Yeah. How have those revenue sources... How have they performed lately? And then how does the Oregon system compare to other states?
We're having some terrible trouble. This will be the super... Yeah. Our microphones...
It's got to be there.
It has to be that.
And then lastly, just touching base on the kicker and reserve accounts. So to start off with, the 1921, for the projections for the 1921 biennium, taken from the governor's budget, the all funds budget is just about $87 billion, with the largest share of that coming from other... Okay. Coming from other funds. So this includes, it can include various other taxes, interest, and so forth. Federal funds account for about 20 or 25 billion or 29%. And this is money that comes from the federal government and gets directed. There are strings attached. So how that money is spent is directed by and then coming in third is the general fund at about $22.5 billion for 1921. So that's about 26% of all funds. And then coming in fourth here is lottery funds, the $1.2 billion. And throughout the session, this committee usually deals with the general fund and some lottery issues. So in terms of the whole pie of the revenue source of the $87 billion, it's about the $23 billion that this committee tends to focus on.
Nancy. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you describe a little bit better or a little bit more about the other funds? Are those, are they like federal dollars with strings attached? Are they directed to particular areas, or do they end up going into the general fund in some way, shape, or form?
They don't go into the general fund. They would be things like the weight mile tax, gas taxes,
okay,
other taxes.
Okay.
They go into there, but they don't go into the general fund.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to flush through that a little bit further on those other funds. That could be everything from a teacher's license to a doctor's license. And so statutorily, we could use those other funds for general fund purposes, but the politics of some of that is just horrendous. But there, as was just shared with us, others we could not touch. The one thing I want to go back to on that chart, though, that's really important, this committee gets it, but I'm not sure the public understands, is on those federal funds and other funds, there are tremendous opportunity costs that come with those, and using the term strings. Quite often, we have to use our general fund and lottery funds to leverage additional federal funds. And quite often, we've had to use our general fund and lottery funds to backfill other funds when they're not sufficient to get us through a biennium. And so I think that's really, really important for this committee as you're looking at revenue to understand there are ways and means implications that come from the fact if we don't manage this side of the equation correctly.
So drilling down a little bit into the general fund, this shows that the vast majority of the general fund, and as I think most committee members are aware, it comes from personal income tax. That's projected to be about 89% for the 1921 biennium. And then the next largest is the corporate excise and income tax at about $1.1 billion. So that's about another 5%. So taken together, that's about 94% of the general fund that comes from some form of income tax. So that's a high concentration. And then we have 3% from other taxes. This includes things like the estate tax. There's some tobacco tax money that goes into the general fund. And then another 3% from other revenue. There's some fines and fees. There's some liquor apportionment interest that makes up the other 3% of the general fund. So in accordance with this pie chart, there's a lot of attention paid to income tax policies and corporate tax policies. So diving a little bit into that, the all funds revenue. So this is that first pie chart with more detail. And we can see that the taxes account for just under $29 billion. So that's general fund taxes, as well as some other taxes. You have medical provider taxes, gas taxes, weight mile taxes. And then federal funds are that $25 billion. And all of that totals, those are by far the largest share of the all funds revenue. So what are the discretionary revenue sources? To build on this a little bit, the focus here has been the general fund, the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, and other, and then lottery. Within lottery, about 85% comes from video lottery. And there are a number of constitutional and statutorily directed funds where, for example, the Education Stability Fund gets 18%, the Parks and Natural Resources Fund gets 15%, and so on. And then that leaves about 59% for debt service and allocation. And most of that allocation goes to the state school fund. Some of it can go to agencies, but that's always a discretionary call. So historically, the income and property tax, so going back to 1970-71, the fiscal year, we can see that prior to 1990, the largest revenue source in the state was actually the property tax. And then right here is where Measure 5 kicked in, so that reduced the property tax burden. And then since that time, personal income tax has been the primary source of revenue for the state. And one of the things that this chart shows is the phase in of Measure 5, and then taxes went up for 1 year, and then Measure 50 came into play. And then it's been in a fairly steady climb since. With the structure of the property tax, it's the assessed value of existing properties kept at 3%, so the growth in taxes has been kept fairly stable. The income tax, on the other hand, is one that responds to the economy and rises and falls with the economy. So we have strong growth through the 90s, and then we hit the 02 recession right here where it collapsed or fell. And then we had a recovery, and then we hit the 08, 09 recession. And that stayed down for a few years, and then it's been on a pretty strong growth since that time. Another piece here is the corporate income tax. While it has grown over time, in percentage terms, it's become a smaller share of the revenue that has come into play.
Thank you, Chair. Does the property tax reforms, can you talk a little bit about how they impacted personal as opposed to business property taxes? Is there an equivalent impact?
I think Jamie will get into that a little bit more.
Okay.
Generally, with the reforms, there's been more of a shift away. If you look at property tax as kind of a household business split, there's been a shift from businesses to household. And in the most recent tax statistics put out by the Department of Revenue, about 55%, 56% is paid by residential property.
So then the conclusion is, as you look at this chart, that we have shifted responsibility for taxes in sort of multiple ways to individuals, both through the income tax, personal income tax, and through a shift in the property tax burden. Is that correct?
Through the shift in the property tax with the fairly steady growth, and then the concentration of the income tax and the expanding of the base, yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a general rule is never show me a chart, because I'll have about 17 questions for you. And one of those is, these are in dollars based on each year, so it's not been normalized for 1986 dollars. So there's inflation built into this, correct? And also, I was wondering if we could get that. You pointed out where Measure 50 happened and when the recession happened. I was wondering if we could get this chart, or I could get this chart, with those things annotated on it, just so I have a good reference, because I'm getting older, I hear, and my memory is not as good as it used to be, so I like to have things written down. Thank you.
So one of the questions we get is context. So stepping away from the Oregon specifically and looking at the dominant taxes used by states, I went in and dug into some census data, and that's actually going to be a big chunk of this presentation later, is comparing Oregon to other states. But here are, for state revenues, the comparison of the income taxes and sales taxes over the past 10 years. And these are the percentage change in fiscal years. So a couple of things stand out here. The blue bars are the sales and gross receipts tax, basically consumption taxes, what economists consider consumption taxes. And the green bars are the income taxes. This one is split out personal and corporate. So one of the things that jumps out is the corporate income tax has the biggest swings, potentially. It's gone up by over 20% and declined by 20% depending on the situation. Whereas the income tax has tended to change between around 10% plus or minus 10%. Now keep in mind that the period that we're looking here, I just chose 10 years, and what we have here is just one notable recession. And then we've had pretty strong growth and steady growth since that time period. So within that, but this tends to hold true regardless of the time period, is that the corporate income tax can swing much more than the other taxes. And then the sales and gross receipts taxes, regardless of the year, it tends to be a little bit more, have more moderate growth. So in the good times, it doesn't grow as much. And in the bad times, it doesn't shrink as much. So for example, during that, the last recession we had, the housing crisis, the corporate income tax declined for 3 years in a row. The personal income tax declined for 2 years in a row. And the gross receipts tax fell for just 1 year, and then had 1 year of very technically positive, but essentially flat growth. Now, this is for all of the states. a couple of caveats. Going back through this, I can't control for policy changes. This is just information reported to the state. So as the various state legislatures responded to whatever was going on in their state, that's embedded in these numbers. So just a couple of caveats.
Is this all income or reported income? I'm not even sure how to ask the question, but would it include income that's held only in the U.S. or income outside the U.S.?
These are the taxes paid on the income. So it depends on, there's a lot behind that question about where that income is loaded. So if we're talking corporations and the money is held overseas, and it's not entering the tax system unless it triggers mm-hmm. some sort of exceptions. Mm-hmm. This is just taxes paid to the states. So the personal income taxes or the individual income tax, the corporate income tax, and then the sales taxes. So these are tax collections.
So if tax collections goes down, it's not necessarily true that corporate income or wealth reduced by a like amount. It may be other situations related to taxable income that led to lower tax collection.
Yes, one of the themes you'll find is that regardless of the information that we can present and share, there's always a lot behind that. And it helps provide insight into one perspective. This is just total collections. So it doesn't account for policy changes made by states. It doesn't account for specific actions taken by stakeholders, taxpayers. So this is just the bottom line, how much came into the state. This is census information that gets reported by the states every year. So it's just kind of that bottom line. So it's a tip of the iceberg, if you will, in terms of the changes over the past 10 years. The idea here is how these respond. So within that, so bouncing back to Aura again, there's a lot of discussion about tax burden, and there are a few different ways to consider tax burden. This chart, I have the property tax and income tax burdens as a percent of personal income. As we go through the presentation here, a lot of the tax burden is presented in two kind of large or macro perspectives. Take taxes divided by the number of people, so there's a per capita issue, and divided by personal income. So those are overall total percentages or dollar amounts on the per capita. They don't get at how that burden aligns across the income spectrum, you know, low income to high income. These are just total. So here we see is another way of looking at before and after basically the reforms measure 5, which is right here. Prior to that, the property tax accounted for about more or less 4.5 to 5% of personal income. And why we view it this way at a high level is personal income is a source where all of the taxes comes from. So you have personal income by the private sector, and how much of that personal income is going to pay taxes? And that's a notion of tax burden. So prior to measure 5, it was 4.5, maybe 5% of personal income went to pay the property tax. Since measure 5, and measure 50 is right here, so since the reforms of the 90s, that percentage has been down to about 3%. One thing to keep in mind with this type of measurement, just about every measurement has pros and cons. And one of the cons here is that it's a percent of personal income. So if taxes stay the same and income falls, then the percentage goes up. So what's happening right here with this percentage increasing isn't that the property tax necessarily went up. This was the recession. So personal income tax, the slideshow wants me to hurry up. So property taxes, which are fairly steady, continued to increase during the recession. But personal income went down, so that percentage went up a bit. For the income tax, it's been on a fairly steady climb. It tapered a little bit through the 90s, but prior to the 90s, it was increasing from 2.5% to about 3%. And then since then, it's probably averaged right around 4%, but it's been very much up and down over time with the recession, the 02 recession, and then the housing recession. Since the recession, we've been on the increase here. We've been on a steady climb, and this is where there's a lot of media coverage around waiting for the next recession. Okay, we've been growing now for 10 years, and one of the common quotes is that growth periods don't die of old age. So there's always concern about, everybody's looking for what's going to trigger the next recession. But this is, we do have 10 years of pretty solid growth here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
This makes what, 5 out of 17?
Yeah, exactly.
We're getting there. Thank you for keeping track. It's otherwise, so as personal income grows, people jump from one bracket to another, which then would affect this chart as far as how much they pay, but they may also have greater deductions or tax credits they can take advantage of. Is that a correct statement?
Generally, yes. Oregon system, we have four brackets, 5, 7, 9, and 9.9. And Kyle will get into this much more detail tomorrow. But we get to the 9% bracket pretty early. And by early, I mean at a low income level. Single filers hit the 9% at about $8,000, and joint filers hit 9% at about $16,000. So we hit 9% pretty quickly. Then the next bracket, the 9.9%, kicks in at about $125,000 for single filers, and $250,000 for joint filers.
Okay.
And it is true that the higher income filers tend to have more deductions.
Right.
And a lot of that ties in to itemizing deductions, which once you buy a home, now you're paying property taxes, you have a mortgage, and those kinds of things.
Right.
And despite the changes at the federal level, we're still expecting about 45% to 50% of Oregon filers to itemize their deductions. Hmm. That's going to fall off dramatically at the federal level, but we're not expecting it to fall off for Oregon. So volatility and annual change or biennial change of revenue is always an issue and a point of discussion for the state. So going back to the 91-93 biennium, I have a chart here that is the percentage change from biennium to biennium. So this is not the dollar amounts. This is just how it changed from one biennium to the next, which enters the discussions on the ways and means side for spending and how next biennium compares to this biennium. So over this time period, the average biennial growth has been about 11.5%. So that's going from a two-year number to a two-year number. So to annualize that, you're talking 5 to 6% growth per year. That's how you get to the 11.5% growth over a biennial. But the blue bar shows the actual percentage changes. So we had 15 to 20% growth for a few biennia, and then we actually had less growth in the 97-99. Now, a couple of things to point about this chart. This red line is the zero bracket. So any point above that is actually positive growth. It's just whether or not we're growing by 18% or 7%. We have had two biennia where there were actual declines. That's the 02 recession and the 08 recession, where revenues fell by 6 or 7%.
Madam Chair, I want to add one other thought here. By the way, I really appreciate what you're doing here. This is really, really good information. So it's important for the committee and for the public to understand So even though you'll see revenue growth above the red line, that doesn't necessarily mean it's keeping up with current service level. And so the state could have additional revenue coming in, but because of many unknown circumstances, population growth, requirements from the federal government, inflation, we cannot be meeting the current services in ways and means. And so it's really important for this committee again to understand that the work we're going to do here impacts ways and means. And so quite often I'll hear the public say, revenue's up. Well, revenue may be up, but that doesn't necessarily match up with where service levels are. I just wanted to get that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Smith. Yes.
Thank you, Manager. And one thing that's not, that would probably be good to peel out of this is the non-discretionary revenue. I mean, you know, the highway taxes and the stovepipes, other revenue that we get that is leveraged revenue, and it's purely directed revenue. I mean, that goes to some of the needs as they come out, but it's not as nearly as discretionary and as easy as someone would think.
That's a good point. This chart is just general fund revenue. And so you do get into issues that are as was mentioned earlier, going for federal match dollars. So the notion of discretionary does come into play. This is the general fund. This is net of the kicker. So the effect of the kicker adds to some of this volatility. It comes into play. And where we are right now, going into 1921, the growth is going to be around 5%. But a big chunk of that is the kicker that would go out.
At some point, when we're discussing revenue and the kicker specifically, I hope that you or one of the other LRO staff will give us a quick little timetable, sequence of events that illustrates how far in advance an economist has to be predicting, I don't even want to say projecting, but predicting what may happen, how many months into the future. It's in excess of a year. I'd like to see that timetable as a reminder for the how realistic it is to expect that you all can be accurate over that long period of time.
Do have a couple of slides on that, Dan, that touches on part of it, but not. Well, we can certainly get you whatever information isn't today.
Yeah, when you're making those estimates, when budgets are prepared, and then when a kicker kicks, the span of time.
Mm-hmm. So the next thing here that's tied to embedded in the state and local system is the state's share of responsibility for schools. This is another thing that has switched, where give or take right now for the share of operating revenue, we're at about 65% comes from the state and 35% comes from local governments. And we actually just had some questions this morning, and this excludes the role of the federal government. So overall funding for schools is about 60% from the state, 30% local, and 10% federal. So this is just a share of kind of an own source within the state and local system, kind of setting aside the federal. We have about this 2-to-1 share, and that changed with back in the 90s as well. So the next few slides try to get at the notion of how Oregon compares to other states. And this is a question that always comes up, and the saying is that once you've studied one state's public finance system, you understand one state's public finance system. Doesn't stop the questions from coming, and the best way to answer those questions, our first stop is census data. Again, this is to give an overall high-level view. And every statistic or every metric here provides some information, but there's always a lot more information behind it. And what we do here is basically normalize taxes. And by that, we take the amount of taxes collected, whether we're talking about total income, property, and divide it by either the people in the state or the income. So that gives us a way to talk about the 50 states and total taxes per person. So it's not necessarily helpful in designing specific tax policies and so forth, because it doesn't get at burden across income levels. But it's that overall picture. You take a state system, how much was collected in taxes, and either divided by the people, so you get this per capita number, or you can get this per income, percentage of income. And that really just allows this kind of comparison. So the most recent data from the census is 15-16 census data. And total revenue, state and local, for Oregon then was $11,770 per capita. So just under $12,000 per capita. And that puts us at 12th among the states.
And to underscore, the title of the slide is state and local. Okay.
So it's the state and local system. And within that total, that 11.7 is broken out into three pieces. We have general revenue, which is the lion's share of it, about $10,000. And then government enterprises, think liquor stores here, that's $500. And then insurance trust at about $1,000. So think workers' comp, unemployment insurance, the money that those earn. So while total revenue, we're at 12th, for general revenue, we're at 14th, government enterprises, we're at 15th, and then for trust funds, we're at third. Most of the questions, now we can take this and we can delve into this a little bit deeper, where we have the general revenue of 10,000. We look at how much federal dollars we pull in, and then what we call own source revenue. Own source revenue, basically taxes, income taxes, property taxes, and so forth. So for general revenue, about $2,700 is federal, and we're ninth there. And for own source revenue, it's about $7,500, and we're 18th there. And again, that's just that first look at where we rank. So if we look at, okay. If we look at how we've changed, since just trying to touch on that, provide some historical context, back in 1990, so this is most of what I'll be focusing on here are those general sources. And if we go back to fiscal 90, how those general revenues were divided up among taxes, federal dollars, and then charges and miscellaneous. Charges, think higher ed tuition, and miscellaneous, kind of think lottery. That's where those come from. So back in 1990, about 54% of our revenue came from taxes. By the time we get to 15-16, about 45% of our revenue comes from taxes. So the shift shows up in federal. We've gone from 20% to 27% of our Fed. So we've done a better job of pulling federal dollars down for all of the pros and cons that go along with that. We're relying more on federal dollars, so that federal leveraging. And then for charges, we are relying more on charges. So over this time period, we went from about 13% of the funds from charges to 20% on charges. Again, the biggest driver there would be higher ed tuition. So if we look at how that compares to the U.S., I don't have the 90 figure for the U.S., but the 15-16 figure for the U.S. looks more like Oregon back in 1990 than we do now. So for all of the states combined, about 53% of their general own source revenue, general revenue comes from taxes. And then 23% from federal and 17.7% from charges and miscellaneous. So if we drill down, so now if we take those same categories, taxes, federal dollars, charges, and miscellaneous, and just look at the per capita. So this $10,163 figure, breaking that out among these categories, that is divided where taxes represent just under $4,600. Federal is the $2,700. Charges are about $2,000 and miscellaneous about $800.
And Chair, can we go back? Can we go back one slide? I'm going to ask a question that's a little unfair, so let's just kind of state about 30,000 foot. On those federal dollars, and I'm going to use the wrong terminology, so hang with me on this. On those federal dollars, how much of those do you think are pass-through versus capital dollars for construction where the state is matched using its dollars to gain federal dollars for capital projects? And the reason I ask that is I'm trying to, well, you know what, I'm wrong, because the transportation package was after the date you have on there.
Healthcare?
Yeah, so I'm just trying to get a sense of how much is pass-through money versus capital dollars to build stuff where federal money was leveraged.
Mm-hmm. There was ARRA. There was the ARRA.
Right, right.
Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
Right.
Money.
I don't have that breakdown. My general sense is that we've been moving toward the matching program, and that's been a big piece of it, but I don't know. But that's just kind of a general sense. I can't tie it to the exact share. We can get that breakdown.
No. It's not a fair question. I was just kind of trying to get a wraparound. Then I saw the date on that. But
you are right. It is both pieces.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So drilling down into this per capita number, the 10,163. So for all states, so the total revenue for Oregon per capita in 15-16 was 10,163. When we look at all states, overall, the overall average was just under $9,400. So on from this particular metric, Oregon is getting about $800 more per capita. Then we can look at, well, where is that difference coming from? So we can compare each of these categories. Taxes, Oregon, we're at about $4,600. And for the states, for all states average, it's about $5,000. So we get $400 less on the tax side. The big difference is on the federal side. We're getting $2,700 per capita, and most states get around $2,150. And then the next largest difference is charges, where we get $2,000 compared to most states about $1,500 in charges. Yes.
Representative Marsh. Thank you. Like Rep. Smith, I just want to drill a little bit, if we can, into the federal number. Is some of that because of health care? I would assume that there are matching federal funds, and our aggressive attitude toward Medicaid expansion is bringing in more federal money, perhaps in comparison to other states.
That's my intuition on where a lot of the growth has come, but I don't have the exact details breakout, but we can try to get that. And keeping in mind, the time lag here is also important, because this is 15-16. There is a notable time lag for getting the census data, because all of the states reported to the census, and this just came out this fall, so we won't get new numbers until next
fall. It might be interesting to ask, even more generally in the human services area, in addition to healthcare, especially if we're talking about 15-16, what role does SNAP or food assistance, housing assistance, mm-hmm. and some of the other human service program funding?
And then miscellaneous is more or less the same, $700 to $800, just kind of rounding the figures. But so it's important from this perspective, whether we're talking about total revenue or taxes or federal. And so as you're talking to folks and hearing from folks, context is really important. Whether the point is growth in the general fund versus current service level, or some of these tax burden perspectives, because the details matter. So to drill down a little bit into the taxes here, so we have the $45.77 for Oregon and the $49.84 for all states. That shows up here as the total, and this is broken down by six kinds of taxes. And I've also included in here tax as a percent of income. So on a per capita basis, we're at about $400 less per person, but on a percentage of income basis, we're about the same, 10.3% of personal income. So even within these, there's the question of where does that tax burden lie? And the biggest difference, and I don't think this will be a surprise to anybody, is the top two here, we have personal income and general sales. So on a per capita basis, Oregon's tax burden is $1,900 per person for the personal income tax and zero for the general sales tax. Other states, on average, they have about $1,200 from each of those, from the personal income and the general sales tax. So while Oregon gets all of the money from the personal income tax, the other states, on average, split that burden between the sales tax and the personal income.
Okay.
And that even holds true on a percentage basis. So for Oregon, about 4.3% of personal income goes to the income tax. And for other states, it's about 4.8% when you combine the personal income and the general sales tax. The other items tend to line up pretty closely. The property tax, we're roughly the same on a per capita basis. We're less than other states. On a personal income basis, we're about the same. And so that same thing with corporate income tax and even selective sales taxes, we're on about par with other states. And selective sales taxes would be things like the tobacco tax and so forth.
Chris, would you please note that at some point when we're discussing corporate income and personal income tax, that I would like the LRO staff to help us understand how much is being reported and taxed as personal income that might have been taxed as corporate, except that the way we do our taxes, there's pass-through income that's passed through from business activity but then reported on personal income tax. I'm not sure how to what extent other states do this, but it
I'd like to understand how much of a change it has made over time in our showing personal income versus corporate income because of switching and allowing pass-through.
Yeah, we can get you more detail just off the top of my head. For the personal income tax, give or take 10% of that is from business income, from pass-through entity income. And then other states, I think they largely have the same kind of structure, but we can get you more detail on mm-hmm. that and how that's changed over time.
Interesting.
So here's another way of looking at and this reliance on the different taxes, focusing on the Western states. So for the U.S., we show the same, what we kind of continuing the same story, where about 35% of, now this is just state, not state and local, so I've kind of focused on state issues here. So for state revenues, it's about 35% personal income and about 30% of general sales taxes. These are all states on average. And so then how do the states differ from that average? So Oregon, we have about 70% of state resources from the personal income tax. And then a distant second is selective sales taxes at about 12 or 13%. And Oregon does have the distinction of having the greatest reliance on a single tax. So that this 70% figure here for a single tax is the highest figure for any of the states. Coming in second historically has been Washington. They have the next focused tax system, and they rely about 60% on general sales tax. Now, this includes their B&O tax. It's a gross receipts tax, so it gets reported as a sales tax and a consumption tax. So for Washington here, this is their retail sales tax and their B&O tax. I actually think in 15-16, for the first time, Washington may have fallen to third. I think Texas just edged them out at maybe a half a percentage point more on their taxes. The same kind of situation, they have a gross receipts tax and their sales taxes. But as members on the committee are fully aware, the dynamic of Oregon and Washington being neighbors and having diametrically different tax systems creates some interesting situations.
That might impact a bridge over a river.
For example.
Representative Finlay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, if you could, the slide back paints a pretty good picture that, you know, our corporate taxes are higher than all the states. But could you make this chart using the same data as the next chart so we can look at specifically at our neighbors and not the entire country? As businesses look at us now, they're saying, well, on a national scale, Oregon's corporate tax is higher than the national group. But let's look at and compare that locally as we talk about whether we want to raise that corporate tax level or not, because let's look at our neighbors, because that's who we're directly competing with for those businesses. Can you see what I'm saying?
I think so. So in this chart right here, the purple represents the corporate income tax.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that this chart doesn't do, because, for example, the Washington number is the retail sales and the gross receipts, those are combined here because that's how it's reported in the census. So I think part of what you're asking is kind of splitting that out and looking at a business tax burden.
Because when you go back to the prior chart, when you add personal income and property, which would be theoretically on the individual side, you add that number, then you add the all states, add the personal income, the sales, and the property, then we could compare apples and apples a little better. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Smith-Warner and then Rush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And rather than just saying this as an aside to Rep. Finlay, part of that too, though, is the whole where general sales tax doesn't just impact personal income tax. In many states where it has it, it's a big part of corporate tax. So just the point that it's not, even though we're at 04 and nationally it's at 03, if you include the fact that we don't have a sales tax is part of why, because those folks, it looks lower on the corporate side because they are paying part of theirs in sales tax in a way that they aren't here.
I think what Rep. Smith-Warren, you're getting at the burden of the tax.
Yes.
And roughly speaking, about a third of the retail sales tax is attributed to business. We've seen other studies conducted by Cost and Ernst & Young that show it about for the retail sales tax. It's not just a tax on households.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we have four little experiments going on here between the four different states. In Oregon, we're heavily reliant on personal income tax. In Washington, heavily reliant on sales tax. Idaho's kind of in between. Washington's kind of in between. I guess what I'd like to see is some, going back to 89 before the recession in 90-91 and the recession 02 and the recession in 09, is how did these four states weather those storms with the different mixes of taxes they have? So I guess what I'm looking for is a way to build a tax policy that is predictable and as recession-proof as possible.
Thank you for raising that.
Sure.
When I was thinking about the one chart you had illustrating volatility, it would be interesting to see Washington's, for example, experienced over that same period and the volatility of their revenue sources.
Right. If corporate tax is the most volatile and sales tax is the least volatile and personal income tax is in between there, how does that play out in over time with the different economies?
Basically, this chart, we can break that out for those states individually, collectively, and get that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Representative Hernandez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With the federal tax changes, I imagine that percentage for the U.S. on corporate taxes will change since this is 2015-16?
Yes, that's a good point. This is just 15-16, so we're not even close to including the Tax Cut and Jobs Act in terms of this data source. Now, we can certainly look at that information either at the federal level or at the state level as we're moving forward. We have, in terms of access to the information, we have the fastest access to our information through our own Department of Revenue. Where we can run into some problems is in these kinds of comparisons, but that doesn't limit us on collections for the state and the federal government. And we can get some information. A lot of states report their actual collections, and even focusing on state collections, I can get some of that stuff more timely. This is really limited because it's the comprehensive state and local system. Okay, so the last few slides I have here are on the kicker and the reserve funds.
Is that the official logo?
I like it.
Okay, so just so committee members are aware, and I can try and touch in on some of the timeline that the chair was referring to. But basically, the 2% kicker, or the surplus refund, is based on all general refund, and we take all general fund revenue, and that's divided into two pots. We have the corporate income tax pot and then everything else. So the everything else we tend to refer to as the personal kicker, and that's because it goes back to personal income tax filers, and it is mostly personal income taxes, but it does include all of the other non-corporate revenue. So we're talking estate taxes, and this slide is possessed. So we have those two pots, and so the calculation is based in two points of time. So the official estimate that sets the bar for the kicker is at the close of the regular session. So for the 17-19 biennium that we're in right now, the state economist made his estimate in May of 2017. So that's where the bar was set. So in May of 17, he came in and said, well, this is my best estimate as to how much revenue is going to come in over the next 2 years, all the way through June of 2019. And it's not it's total revenue, but it's each of the pieces too. He estimates them separately, the personal income tax, the corporate income tax, the estate taxes, and all of those summed up set the bar for the kicker. Now, he makes that estimate, made that estimate in May of 17, and then there also may have been legislative changes during the 17 session made by the Assembly. Those get added to that estimate. And the combination of the May forecast and any the impact from any legislative changes, the sum of those two estimates is what we refer to as the close of session estimate. And that close of session estimate is released in September when he releases the September forecast. And so the September forecast actually contains two key tables: the close of session estimate, which is just the estimate he made in 17 in May, plus legislative changes, and then right away he's updating that with the September forecast. And every updated forecast basically consists of two pieces: looking back at the prior 3 months and seeing how accurate we were versus now what does the future look like. So the bar is set there in May of 17. So once we get to July 1st of 2019 is when we will look back and say how much revenue actually came in. And so this summer, and now it takes a month or 6 weeks to actually finalize the book, so it doesn't. I'm describing it as though it happens overnight, and it doesn't happen that quickly. But on July 1st, we'll know how much revenue came in for the prior 24 months. And so that close of session estimate compared to that actual determines whether or not the kicker kicks. And if, again, these are two pots I'm describing simultaneously, if the actual revenue is at least 2% larger than forecast, then the kicker is kicked, and then all of the revenue above that close of session forecast goes back to taxpayers. Now that's pretty much locked.
That's just on the personal side. The corporate side does not go back to the taxpayer.
That's correct. That's a good point. Yes.
And it's all of it, not the amount over 2%.
Correct. It's all of it.
That's another interesting point. Smith Warner, then Rashke.
I was pointing that direction. Let's go to Representative
Smith Warner and Smith. I want to point out, Greg, you have the May estimate is added to the legislative changes for the long session, and that becomes the total. But if there are any revenue changes that come out of the short session in between, those will just count against whatever the revenue forecast is. Those are not.
That's a good point.
Those do not come. So if we do some significant revenue reform of any kind in the 18 session, if more revenue comes in because of that, doesn't matter. It's not accounted for. You're still based on that 2017 forecast.
That's correct. And we've had recent experience with that. Not only the short session, but any to your point, any special session. So we had a special session in 2013 that resulted in some revenue changes, and those were predicted to affect the revenue stream, but that didn't change this threshold. So that threshold is written in stone, because it's in the Constitution within the May forecast. It's that number. The only way it can be changed, and it can be changed by the legislature, it takes a 2/3 vote in each chamber. And the way that mechanically works is that the legislature officially changes the estimate. So if the estimated general fund revenue is $20 billion and the legislature chooses to modify the kicker, then there will be a bill that says the official close of session estimate is no longer $20 billion, it's $21 billion, is how the bill actually works. So the legislature changes that estimate. It's the most direct way, given the trigger and all of the mechanisms, it's the most direct way. So given that, you can change it so that there is no kicker or reduce the kicker. There is that ability.
We had Representative Smith and Rush.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask a really pointed question, but you're on our team, so I'm going to ask this. How challenging is it, in your opinion, for the state economists to get within that error of the 2%? Because we hear that all the time as elected officials. In your opinion, is that a challenge?
I would say it is a challenge. So over the course of 2 years, it's 2%. So on an annual basis, it's 1%. And most states budget on an annual basis. So they are focused on making projections for the next year. And part of the challenge is that second year, any error in the first year is compounded by the second year. So if that first year you're up by a percent,
right,
well, you've already are already kind of on that trajectory. And what we've seen with the way our tax system responds to the economy, with relying on the income tax, which is very responsive to the economy, once we get on that trajectory, it kind of builds. And so when we're halfway through the biennium and we're already up, it tends to continue in that pattern for the second year. So at the end of that first year, there aren't any kind of mid-season adjustments that we can make, so to speak.
Thank you, I appreciate that. I've actually heard you give that answer in the past. And so Madam Chair, I think this is something we need to recognize that, you know, this is part of our public policy that we ought to be scratching our head over, knowing exactly the answer that was just given to us by someone who represents and works with us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the estimate's just not for the exercise of the kicker. The estimate is also to help budget for the next 2 years. Is that correct?
The primary source is that the estimate comes in, and that's what the legislature can spend.
That's what it can spend. So then anything that comes out additional to that,
right
now, personal income tax gets sent back to the taxpayer if that estimate was too low, I guess. Yeah.
And that was the argument put forward, back in 79 when it was passed. That was the argument for it. Okay, that was money that wasn't budgeted for the upcoming biennium. So it was, from that perspective, it wasn't needed to meet that budget. And so that's why it goes back. That was the justification for it back then. Okay,
thank you.
And I think I already touched on all of this. So that's where we get to kind of the surplus refund. So we're in July 1 of 2019, there'll be the surplus refund for the two pots. And the corporate kicker does go, it's dedicated to K-12 since 2014, so that doesn't have that same mechanics. But on the personal side, there's the mechanics of getting it back to taxpayers. So with that surplus refund, we calculate a percentage, and the state economist is tasked with doing this. So whatever that surplus refund is, now it's a surplus for 2 years, it gets refunded to taxpayers on a one-year liability. And so that surplus refund is divided by the pre-credit liability for a given year, and then you get a percentage, and that's where we find out our kicker percentage is 5% or 6% and so forth.
Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Why is the reason it's done over 1 year as opposed to 2 years? If it's accrued over 2 years, then it's given back, quote unquote, in 1 year. Why is it 1 year, not 2 years, in the refund process? Do you have an idea why that was done that way?
I don't know what kind of debate happened back then. My guess at this point, and it is a guess, is just administratively, it's what's going back. So just refund it. Just do it one time.
Easier then. Okay.
And it is, so how the percentages generally work, so we have this 2% threshold. So if the surplus refund, we just passed that and we're at 2.5% above the forecast, then generally the kicker percentage is going to be roughly twice that percentage. So if once we hit that 2% mark, the kicker is triggered. If we end up being at 2.5%, that's generally going to mean about a 5% kicker, just using very rough math. There's a lot more behind that, but just roughly speaking, okay, that's what it is. And on the personal side, for the first 15 years, it was a credit on tax returns that was changed to a check in 1995. And then in 2011, it was changed back to a tax credit. So just touching on this and trying to wrap up here, we have some of the history here. Over the time, the personal kicker has triggered about $3.5 billion reduction since its inception. The current personal kicker is about $724 million, and the current corporate kicker is $230 million. Again, the corporate kicker goes to K-12. All of the calculations are still done. It just goes to K-12. For each of these, the personal kicker has been triggered 11 times out of 19 biennia, and the corporate 10 times out of the 19 biennia. So what that tells us, or what we interpret from that, is the unbiased notion of the revenue forecast. About half the time where the kicker is being triggered and half the time it's not. And the goal for the revenue forecast is to hit that sweet spot where when they present that forecast in May, there's a 50% chance it's going to be high and a 50% chance it's going to be low. The personal kicker was suspended once back in 1991. The corporate kicker prior to being dedicated, K-12 had been suspended twice in 93 and 07. In 07, it was the seed money for the rainy day fund. So in terms of trying to get at how easy it is to hit the bar, I have a couple of charts here for the personal kicker and the corporate kicker. And to start off with, I have to confess to a presentation sin that I've committed here, in that the personal kicker ranges between 15% and minus 15%. The corporate kicker ranges between 80% and minus 60%. So this is a little bit deceptive. So arguably I should put them on the same scale, but if I put the personal kicker on the same scale, everything would happen within this range. So the sweet spot, so to speak, is revenue that's up, but not up by the 2%. Because if it's up a little bit, so there's no kicker, perspective on the kicker, there's no kicker, and there's not a recession. On the personal side, that's happened twice over 20 years.
And on the corporate
side, I don't know that it's ever happened. We either have a kicker or it's a recession. So the last things are the education stability fund, the reserve funds. We have two reserve funds. The education stability fund was created in 2002, and it's in the Constitution. And the revenue source is 18% of lottery funds. And the withdrawal is a 3/5 vote in each chamber and a number of economic conditions. The revenue forecast has to be down by 2%, employment has to be down, and the governor has to declare an emergency. And the use, that the money needs to be used for public education, and there is a cap of 5% of the prior biennium's revenue is how much that can be. The rainy day fund was created in 07. It's in statute. And the revenue was that one-time 2007 corporate kicker. The general fund ending balance up to 1% of the prior biennium's appropriation will go to the rainy day fund. And then a portion of the corporate income tax goes into the rainy day fund. And right now, that's on the order of, I think, about $30 million of biennium. The withdrawal is the same, except the governor doesn't need to declare an emergency. Withdrawals can't exceed 2/3 of the beginning balance, and the money can be used for anything that's general purpose, and the cap here is 7.5% of the appropriations.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much about is in each fund right now?
So on this, the next slide here, we have combined, it's about $600 million in each fund, so a total of $1.2 billion, or at least that's a projection for the end of the biennium.
Okay.
So we're not exactly there, but this is where we're on track to be by the end of the biennium, is to have $1.2 billion in these reserve funds.
Yes.
One other question then. Thank you, Madam Chair. How much would you estimate we would need in each fund to weather another, let's just say the 02 recession? What would be a good rule of thumb to have in these rainy day and education stability funds in order, if a recession like the 02 recession happened, or 01, 02, that Oregon would be safe, I guess?
It's an excellent question, and it's the right question because the context there is, if we have enough money set aside to handle any recession, that's a lot of money sitting on the side and into these accounts and not being used. So there isn't a hard and fast correct answer to that. Generally, if we're looking at 5%, a number that gets used a lot is about 5% of the general fund.
Okay.
Helps to weather kind of moderate.
Moderate, okay.
And can I ask you to comment on, as sometimes it's figured in a different way, like, are you trying to ensure that you have 1 month of operating revenue,
right,
or 2 months or 3 months? What does it take to just keep things going? Mm-hmm. And is it all activities or a subset of government activities,
yeah,
over a period of what time?
Madam Chair, I'd also add to that, it gets a little challenging without my calculator here, because if you go back to 2001 when we went into the, I think it was five special sessions, our general fund at the time was approximately $12 to $14 billion, where now is almost $10 billion over that. And so while at that time, and again, I'm using really rough numbers here, I know I'm inaccurate, but it was approximately $1 billion shortfall we had, that's compared to $12 billion versus what we need today. Plus, if you go back and you look at the federal dollars that have increased and the federal match requirements on those, plus contractual obligations that are tied to that, if I had to throw a guess, I'd probably say you're close to $3 billion you would need if you were to take a similar scenario in today's world. And that's really rough. But
and one of the challenges for economists is what the source is for the next recession. There's just general concession that there will be a recession. I don't know that any economists believe that we've beaten that, but where is it going to be? Yeah. And not all of the recessions are the same. I mean, our last two, we have the 02 and the 08, very different. The causes of those recessions were very different. And how to prepare for them in terms of a bank account, it can be very different because you get into prioritizing spending. And there are a lot of complexities there. So to just sum up, some takeaways from this from a strengths and weaknesses perspective on the system. Some of the strengths, we have strong revenue growth over time. As I mentioned, the personal income tax is responsive to economic growth. And so in boom times, we do really well and we have strong growth in the general fund because of that reliance on the personal income tax. So we can have stronger growth than the average state because of the reliance on the income tax. So that's one strength. The use of non-tax revenue, we saw some charts where we rely on charges more so than other states. It reduces the general tax burden. And another aspect of the personal income tax is that it's better at addressing equity concerns. This gets at what economists refer to as the ability to pay principle. Whenever we evaluate a tax system, there are some principles, and two of them, or one of them is the ability to pay. Basically, higher income folks are able to pay more, so they should pay more. So the income tax is consistent with that. The income tax being tied to the federal structure reduces administrative costs. The income tax, so we save some costs there with being able to piggyback on the federal level, federal system. And then the appropriate charges can lead to more efficient allocation, and this is another principle, benefits received principle. And there isn't one of these that answers everything. They're all different aspects of a way to evaluate and create some language to evaluate a system. And then the stability of the local revenue. With the property tax system being the way it's structured, it's a fairly stable source of revenue. Now, the flip side of the coin are some of the weaknesses. So the reliance on the income tax makes the revenue stream unstable. So when it goes down hard. And so that creates problems everybody's familiar with. High income tax rates and the lack of diversity can create some unfortunate circumstances. One of the themes within public finance is for taxation, you go for a broad-based low rate. So to the extent that we're relying on one source of income, and a higher rate, that can lead to some distortions in decisions by stakeholders. So the reliance on the federal side, so while it's there's an advantage to leveraging those dollars, you also lose some policy control over those dollars. That was mentioned earlier. Some of the downside of the charges, while that might be more in line with the benefits received principle and some more efficient allocation, it can also create some competitive and equity concerns. So the usual story of higher education, we're relying more on charges there. Does that create problems with access to higher education for citizens? So that's the other side of that coin. And then while the local revenue stream, the property taxes are stable, they're low growth. So if and when, I don't know that any economist believes that we've beaten inflation. I mean, the Federal Reserve tries its best. So the notion that we won't enter into a high inflationary period again is still on the concern. And that's a risk for the local revenue system. If we get into inflation of 4, 5, 6%, then the local revenue system can't respond to that. And I guess I'm done. There we go.
There's one point under strengths that I'd like to explore briefly. Being tied to the federal structure reduces administrative costs. Is this referring to administrative costs to the state or administrative costs more broadly, including to taxpayers?
Generally, it's both. And I'm primarily thinking here the Department of Revenue. And as you deal with bills, there'll be a reconnect bill, mm-hmm. and the CPAs will come in and they talk about that. And one of the advantages for taxpayers is knowing that they have the calculations for the federal, and we just piggyback on that. Mm-hmm. That we start with federal taxable income and we're tied to that. And there will be a debate and discussion and differences of opinions about deviating from that, because we aren't fully connected. We do selectively disconnect from certain provisions. So we are kind of in a middle ground. We're not on the extreme of fully connected or not. We try to thread that needle. Also for the Department of Revenue, when they tie in, they piggyback a lot with the IRS work. And so they'll focus their audit activities on areas where the IRS doesn't, and they will interact with the IRS. So there are some administrative savings there, kind of on both sides, for the state in terms of agencies as well as taxpayers, understanding that there aren't two definitions of income or two definitions of a certain deduction or something.
So I'll get to you in just a second. Thank you. So there are a couple of things that occur to me. One is software handles a lot of this now, and software is designed to handle state rules as well as federal. And it also occurs to me that, how big a deal is it? We're already somewhat disconnected in certain areas. So if it's a really big deal, you talk about the burden of a tax. Is it really worth it to do it? However, if the administrative cost can be covered by additional funding, for example, for Department of Revenue, is the gain greater than the investment that was required? So I hope that someone's prepared to speak to that.
I think they are now. So the CPAs, when they come, they'll be in the best position because they're filing the taxes on how much of a burden is it? Is it all software driven, so it's not that big of a burden now compared to 20 years ago? And then the Department of Revenue, you'll be hearing a lot from the Department of Revenue throughout the session.
Okay, good. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize, I'm asking so many questions. I find this interesting. And so yeah. One of the weaknesses, and I think it's actually the largest weakness or a major weakness, is Oregon's income tax system is just complicated. Yeah. And I think there's folks, and I put myself at the top of the list, that at times I have to scratch my head and say, what does this mean? And I think if we as a committee sometimes find ourselves in that situation, I can only imagine what Oregonians who rely on us think about our system as well. So, just a thought.
Any other questions for Legislative Revenue Office? Thank you very much for the presentation.
Very good, Chris.
Really, really good introduction. Good way to start our session. Anything else to come before the committee? We're adjourned.